Lecture 20, Sartre's Phenomenology.
The starting point of Sartre's great work, Being in Nothingness, is phenomenology. More particularly, it's a phenomenology of consciousness. This would indicate that Sartre is going back to Husserl and saying what Heidegger refused to say, that the subject matter and what we're going to be examining in phenomenology is consciousness itself. Nevertheless, Sartre wants to join with Heidegger in some of his basic critiques of Husserl, and what he wants to say is that in examining consciousness, in doing phenomenology, we are not just examining the objects of consciousness, but what we're also doing is examining the world. So just as Heidegger wants to say, the world and Dasein are one and the same thing, just two different aspects of one unity, Sartre will want to say that there is no separating consciousness from the world, that consciousness in the world or consciousness of the world is a unified phenomenon and it can't be separated. But with this in mind, let me explain, if I can, what I take to be the source of the almost insufferable difficulty of this very large book. There's a philosophical problem behind this. I think probably there's something else going on too, that Sartre set out to write a great book in philosophy. And if you look at history, the great books in modern philosophy have tended to be German. But I think the philosophical problem is subtle and profound. On the one hand, Sartre is a Cartesian, through and through. What this means, something that's often debated, but essentially I take it to be starting with a basic distinction, a dichotomy. On the one hand, there's consciousness. On the other hand, there's the world. How one sees the link between them, or whether or not one identifies them as Sartre and Heidegger try to do, that's a more specialized point. But the basic point is that by separating the discussion into two terms, consciousness on the one hand, the world on the other, Sartre puts himself rather firmly in the French tradition in which he was raised. But Sartre had read Heidegger. He was convinced by the arguments and sometimes even uses the word Dasein in his discussion. But if you look at these two, on the one hand, the Cartesian dualism of consciousness in the world, on the other hand, the Heideggerian insistence that there is no valid distinction to be made here, it's pretty clear that what Sartre has to do is some pretty fancy dancing to come out with a philosophy which is coherent and at the same time embraces both of these viewpoints. And an awful lot of what in Sartre comes off as a kind of very complicated double talk really is an attempt to get these two different views together. But we should never lose sight of what the ultimate aim of the philosophy is and its ultimate point. With Heidegger, there continues to be enormous discussion, essentially about what his philosophy is about, what its point is. With Sartre, there really is no debate at all. He makes it very clear, and it is clear to everyone who reads him. The idea is freedom and responsibility. In fact, what he wants to say, as sort of the beginning of his phenomenology, is that consciousness is freedom. And he rather emphasizes the point that this is an identity relationship, this is what characterizes consciousness. It is not as if freedom is one of the aspects of consciousness or freedom is a property of consciousness, but rather consciousness itself must simply be defined as freedom. And conversely, freedom itself is nothing other than consciousness. Responsibility, on the other hand, is something which is more concrete and in a way more political than philosophical in this very ethereal sense. Responsibility is the idea that we are the incontestable author of our actions. That means that we are always responsible for them. They are our doing. We must take the consequences. And again, there are no excuses. What Sartre does in Being in Nothingness, right from the start, is he gives us a characterization of consciousness. And keep in mind, as I discuss this, that his aims are twofold. First and foremost, to make out this thesis that consciousness is freedom. but secondly, also to join with Heidegger in rejecting what would seem to be a starting point, namely the dualism between consciousness and the world. The problems that follow Cartesianism and dualism are pretty straightforward. Basically, once you find yourself in consciousness, it is very difficult to argue that what you know is the world outside of consciousness. And philosophers have tried many ingenious strategies to try and get from within consciousness out to the world. Sartre responds by striking thesis. What he tells us is that consciousness is nothingness. Consciousness is nothing. And what he means by this is a number of different theses. First and foremost, in terms of phenomenology, when you describe your experience, you describe all the objects of your experience. Perhaps you describe how you feel. Perhaps you describe your orientation. But there's a sense in which what you don't describe is your consciousness as a thing. Rather, consciousness is such that so-called introspection cannot make an object of it. You might say, consciousness is always behind our awareness. The thesis here, as in Husserl, is that consciousness is essentially intentionality, that it is necessarily and always about things. But to understand what this means, we don't have to look at consciousness, as Husserl sometimes did, as a realm, much less as a transcendental ego. But rather, we see consciousness as a kind of activity, pure activity. In fact, one might sort of envision this as looking around a dark room with a flashlight. Consciousness is the beam of the flashlight, and what it does is it illuminates the things in the room. And to complete this picture for Sartre, one has to take away the flashlight and leave only the beam. Because what consciousness is essentially nothing but the awareness of the things in this world. But this is going to be very complicated because it's an awareness which is not just passive and not just receptive. In that sense, it's not like the flashlight beam because it's going to, in fact, be very dynamically active with reference to its perceptions and with reference to the nature of the things that it experiences. One goes back, for example, to his essay on the emotions and thinks about how in an emotion, one dynamically transforms the world by being conscious of it. And it's not just a matter of perceiving things as they are, but rather, it's a way of perceiving things according to a scheme which one imposes. For example, whether one is in a situation of great difficulty or one is looking at something as an aesthetic phenomenon. And it is also a matter in which consciousness transforms the world that it perceives. Part of the importance of talking about consciousness as nothingness, with reference to Sartre's predominant thesis, the thesis about freedom, is that saying that consciousness is nothing allows him to say that it is therefore outside of the causal relations of the world. If this were not so, if the deterministic thesis were true that our minds are in fact the effects of causes, whether in our brains or in the world, or perhaps even of God putting ideas in our minds, then we would not be free. It is important to see consciousness as something independent and distinct from the causal relations in the world, and one can here take on a fairly straightforward Kantian interpretation, and Sartre certainly had read and knew his Kant. But Kant says, for example, much the same thing at one point, that insofar as we see ourselves as agents, as actors, as opposed, for example, to seeing ourselves simply as creatures in the universe, what we do is we separate ourselves from the kinds of causal relations that we usually apply to things and see ourselves as something different. In fact, Kant's thesis here, I think, will serve as a very good slogan for understanding what Sartre's all about. Kant says, insofar as we consider ourselves as agents, we cannot imagine ourselves anything other than free. To put it in a different way, also Kantian, you might say that what consciousness does is it imposes causal categories on the world. It is by seeing the world in a certain way, let's say a scientific way, that we see things in terms of cause and effect relations. But when we examine ourselves and examine our consciousness, that's not the way we see ourselves. He doesn't deny the scientific view of the mind. One can examine, as many philosophers and psychologists are now examining, the neurology of the mind and the psychology in such a way that one does talk about causal ideas of all sorts. Nevertheless, one has to separate here, as Kierkegaard did, between the objective scientific view and the phenomenological first-person action-oriented view. And what Sartre is doing is insisting that for the purposes of his phenomenology, what we always adopt is this first-person action-oriented view of ourselves. And from that point of view, consciousness is nothingness, at least now in two senses. First, it is not a possible object of consciousness. It is not a thing. And second, that consciousness is not caused. And of course, from there, it's a short step to saying, if consciousness is not caused, it is free. The word Sartre often uses here, and again, it's prone to misunderstanding, is the word spontaneity. Now, some philosophers have interpreted spontaneity as a kind of indeterminism, and they've appealed, for example, the free will question to current science and pointed out that in quantum theory, causal relationships break down and whether something happens is purely a matter of chance. But of course, this isn't going to work if we're talking about freedom, because if in fact I acted simply by chance, we would certainly not talk about my actions being free. We want to talk about my actions being chosen, and that's the very opposite of being undetermined. Talking about spontaneity, on the other hand, allows him to carve out a kind of middle range between determinism and indeterminism, and talk about agency on the one hand, but nevertheless emphasize the thesis that he's already made in his essay on the emotions, that much of what we do is pre-reflective. That is, it's not conscious in the full-blown sense. It's not articulate. It's not the subject of thought. It is not the subject of the kind of reflection in which we name what we're feeling or name what we are doing. We just do it. Spontaneity is the freedom of consciousness, which is to say that to understand consciousness is to understand from the outset that consciousness acts, and it acts in such a way that it acts without any prior causality. What Sartre will also have to say, if he's to hold this thesis, is that all the questions that psychologists have traditionally asked about motivation and the like have to somehow be absorbed, if not on the causal side of consciousness, then on the object side of consciousness. And in fact, that's just what Sartre does, that many of the questions about motivation and emotion that are usually attributed to a causal account of consciousness and action, what Sartre will say is that motivation and emotion, in fact, now lie on the object side of emotion, and they are considerations in terms of which we make the choices that we do. I might add that by the time he writes Being and Nothingness, 5 years after his essay on the emotions, one of the things that he has given up is the rather oversimplified thesis that emotions are always a mode of escape behavior. That might work still for some kinds of emotions. I think the fox example with the grapes would be a good instance of that. There are times when we have emotions, and it's pretty clear that the purpose is to save us from some kind of embarrassment or humiliation, even in our own minds. But Sartre, by the time he writes Being and Nothingness, is also aware that emotions have many different purposes and many different ends. And among other things, he is by now, having been through the war, or a good chunk of it, is well aware of the heroic function of emotions too. So what he wants to say is here that emotions are not to be construed as causes of behavior, and that he holds with his old view, but rather emotions are to be construed as spontaneous outpourings of consciousness in which one takes the world in a certain way. So we're not talking about emotions in consciousness, just as in the early essay, we didn't talk in Jamesian terms about emotions as sensations, but rather we're talking about emotions as ways of structuring consciousness, but now as one way among many of structuring consciousness. But the idea that consciousness is nothingness has a further meaning, and one that really makes Sartre's thesis about freedom all the more plausible. One of the most remarkable things about consciousness is the fact that it has the power of negation. To put it very simply, consciousness spontaneously says no. But this isn't just a matter of denial. That would be certainly pathological. It's rather a more pervasive feature of consciousness, which Sartre feels is absolutely essential to understand the nature of consciousness itself, as well as the nature of the freedom he wants to celebrate. In a way, you might say, it's prefigured in Husserl. Husserl gives an example of perception and points out to us that when we look at something, say that coffee cup, in one sense, what I see immediately is the coffee cup from a certain perspective. But at the same time, what I see is a coffee cup, which means, among other things, it has a backside which I don't see. It has an underneath which I don't see. It has weight, which I am not now feeling. It has a texture. And one can imagine if I were to reach for the coffee cup and discover any of these things not being so, I would be shocked and surprised. There's a sense then in which what I see is not just what I see, but it has to do with a host of expectations which are built into the perception itself. So there's a sense in which what I see is always more than what I see. What I see is already defined by expectations of all sorts, including those built into the perception itself, but also more generally having to do with my values and expectations. For instance, I gave the example earlier of a mountain, which might present itself as an obstacle to one people, as protection for another, as an aesthetic object for still another, as a point of recreation, perhaps, for still another. Well, in the same sense, when we see, we are never simply passive receivers. I gave the flashlight example a minute ago, but let me correct that one more way. It's not just that there is no flashlight, but one can't look at the beam as itself simply picking up the reflections that the objects give off. To the contrary, the beam itself is dynamically active, and it structures the way we see things. So, to talk about negation here is to talk in a very powerful way about consciousness with as an activity which is not simply a matter of receiving, as many of the early empiricists suggested, but rather it's a matter of shaping, as the early essay on emotions made quite clear. Now, this has a number of different manifestations for Sartre. For one thing, any situation in which we find ourselves, we can say, I refuse to accept this. In fact, that's very reflective, what I just said. But we have at least one clear set of instances which permeate our lives, in which the power of negation is evident right at the basis of consciousness, even in its most primitive forms. And that's the notion of desire. Because when you think, what is a desire actually? It's not just seeing the world, but it's seeing the world in terms of something you want. If you look at that delicious piece of chocolate cake, it is not just a factual perception, it's not just the recognition, aha, there's a chocolate cake, but rather it's looking with desire. It's looking with already the expectation or the hope that one will quite literally internalize that piece of chocolate cake as soon as possible. We see things in terms of what we can do with them. We see things in terms of how they fit into our plans. One might look, for example, at a notice from the IRS as an opportunity to express oneself, to explain oneself, or I think more realistically for most of us, one might spy the same invitation with a kind of horror as something that is going to interfere with our lives. There is nothing in the fact of the matter that dictates this, but how we perceive it and the expectations. This is all what Sartre builds into this notion of negation. There's a sense in which our perceptions are always filled with negation in another sense as well. Take, for instance, I walk into a bar, and I'm supposed to meet my friend Peter. But I walk into the bar, and I look around, and what I see, quite simply, is that Peter's not there. Now, one can construe this in terms that many philosophers would find plausible, along the lines of what I see is, and now we make a list of all the people in the bar, and all the furniture in the bar, and all the bottles in the bar, and the glasses in the bar, and perhaps the architecture of the bar. And one examines that list and notices that on it, Peter isn't there. Well, That's not the way we experience things. When we go into the bar expecting to see Peter or hoping to see Peter, there is really just one thing that we notice as we walk in and perceive the bar, and that is that Peter is not there. This strange kind of perception, the perception of an absence, the perception of a lack, is of course something we experience all the time. Desire might be construed as nothing but the perception of such a lack. Plato at one point suggests that. There's also the idea that when we perceive a negation, when we perceive an absence or a lack, what we are doing is already construing the world in terms of what is not there. And here we find another interpretation of the notion of nothingness. One might say in quasi-logical terms, among the features of the world, which we must take into account, is the nothingness of the world. And at the extremes, one can understand all kinds of ways in which this might be the case. In particular, there's a sense in which we can perceive ourselves with a kind of dissatisfaction with what we are. Or we can perceive our situation, including our psychological situation. And we can take a step back and distance ourselves. We can think of ourselves not in terms of simply what we are given, but what we insist upon as our own ideals. To take an extreme example, if you're in pain, there's a sense in which the pain is a given, but another important sense in which it is the perception of the pain and possibly the reflection on the pain. We distance ourselves from it. We negate it in the sense, not that we simply make it go away. It'd be nice if we could do that. But rather, we negate it in the sense that we put it at arm's length and now consider how to respond. And whether or not we do this reflectively, deliberately, we do it, in fact, all the time. Am I going to give in to this pain? Am I going to express it loudly and perhaps embarrass myself in front of my friends? Or am I going to be heroic and pretend as if all is well and present myself as a kind of hero to my friends? Or to the contrary, should I use the pain, for example, to get out of an obligation? Or should I consider this a lesson in life? Or should I consider this the punishment of the gods? Again, this idea of setting one's attitude towards one's situation and what one experiences is absolutely essential. In the last lecture, I gave a number of illustrations from the emotions. In anger, we can determine in many ways whether or not we are to get angry and how to use that anger. We can in many ways determine whether or not we are to fall in love. And it's not just a matter of falling, but in many ways deciding. With a trait like cowardice, it consists of a whole series of decisions. In short, all this has to do with the nothingness of consciousness, because without the idea that consciousness is nothing but an activity directed towards the world, intentionality, what we fall back into is something like Freud's psychic determinism, which is what Sartre always wants to get away from as much as possible. Now, a word on phenomenology, or a number of words on phenomenology. Philosophers today, in the analytic tradition, often complain that in Heidegger and in Sartre, there isn't much by way of argument, that rather, they simply seem to present their views or their perceptions of the world as truth. In analytic philosophy, and in traditional philosophy in the West, what we often find is philosophers arguing rather outrageous conclusions on the basis of premises that sometimes are hard to reject. Or alternatively, we find long-standing philosophical arguments that have to do ultimately with an argument over what is self-evident or not by way of premises. There's a sense in which logical argument often threatens to overcome the multidimensionality of experience. So one way of talking about phenomenology, and in particular Sartre's phenomenology, is that what he tries to focus upon are those kinds of key essential experiences that define our experience in general. And he wants to use this in place of the kinds of arguments which philosophers have often given. And what I'd like to do for the rest of this lecture is outline three such examples. The first appears in an early novel that he wrote before he had fully formulated his phenomenological theses in Being and Nothingness. The early novel is called Nausea, which is a wonderful title, And it's an example, perhaps a rather perverse example, of the intentionality of emotions, in that nausea is construed not just as a physical feeling, which we all know too well, but rather nausea has an object. Nausea is a way of construing the world. And in particular, much in line with a good deal of existentialism, especially thinking back to Kierkegaard, what nausea is a kind of dissatisfaction, a kind of revulsion with the apparent meaninglessness of the world. But let me put it in a broader philosophical context. Philosophers have often argued that the status of the external world, or the status of our knowledge of the external world, is in question. And this follows from a set of arguments which we've anticipated many times in these lectures, the idea that somehow we are stuck inside of our own experience or stuck inside our own consciousness. Sartre, as we've seen, is going to deny this by essentially taking the contents out of consciousness, turning it into nothingness, so one can say there is no inside of consciousness to be stuck in. And again, the kind of beam analogy comes to mind. But how do philosophers get into this pickle? Because certainly it is a pickle. Not even insane people believe that there is no external world. Rather, this is a pure philosophical fabrication. And it follows from, basically, the Cartesian position, which says that it is possible to know only one's experiences. And then the question comes up, how do we know the world? But even with a revised notion of consciousness, one has to ask the question, is it true that we know that we see the actual world? Or might it be possible that the world that we see is simply the world of our own construction? A world is simply idea. To answer this, what Sartre does in this rather remarkable early novel is he gives us a character who, in the one sense, is rather like Camus Meursault, in that he is a very kind of eccentric, strange person. But unlike Meursault, he is a highly educated, extremely reflective person, more like Dostoevsky's underground man. And so what we see is, in fact, a person who is overburdened by reflection on the world. And in one critical scene, late in the novel, Sartre has this character go into a park where he sees a tree. He sits down by the roots. And what follows is a description that might be fodder for some contemporary horror movie producer. The tree becomes ominous, and it sort of forces its existence on us. And the idea is that existence is not something which is in any way inferred from the experiences we have, or it is not added to or point of speculation, but rather existence simply forces itself in our experience in a way that is absolutely undeniable. A different example. Sartre talks about walking along the edge of a precipice, and one looks down at the fall beneath, and suddenly one is seized with anxiety. Well, what is anxiety? It's not just fear. One might be afraid, for example, of the ground giving way, or one might be afraid that one's companion will give one a push and one will go hurtling over the edge. But anguish is something different. Anguish is the sudden, spontaneous realization that at any moment I could just intentionally take an extra step, give myself a little push, and I go hurtling to my death. And so I take a step away from the edge. What experience anguish gives me is the basic experience of my own freedom. Or to put it in a Sartrean way, nothing stands between me and my self-destruction except my own decision. Third example is one that appears later in Being in Nothingness, and we'll talk about it in some detail. Philosophers have wondered how I know that other people exist. After all, I know only my own experience. Couldn't all these other people be androids, robots, and have no consciousness at all? Well, what Sartre says is there is an experience that devastatingly shows us that other people cannot be questioned, cannot be denied. If I find, for example, someone looking at me as I am doing something embarrassing, I suddenly experience embarrassment or shame. What I experience is the other person not as an object, but rather the other person as looking at me. And such experiences, Sartre says, are sufficient to undermine any possible philosophical argument to the contrary, that we don't really know other people. What we'll see in what's to follow is how phenomenology is going to highlight other experiences, which are going to give us a good outline about what it means to be human.